Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, and Bristol Community FM. We're back on BCFM, apparently, with a new schedule in the middle of April, Tuesday at noon. This week, The Big Short. Could it happen again? If you saw the film over Christmas, you know what I mean. The Big Short was all about the mistakes in the run-up to 2008. But Britain's national debt is now at £1.5 trillion and climbing fast. Doesn't look like any prospects are of stopping the rise in the deficit all the time. And are we due, then, another 1929-style crash? Not a bailout, a crash this time. An exclusive interview with one of the world's smartest economists, Anastasia Nesvatilova. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, and I'll give our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Anastasia Nesvatilova. I'm Professor of International Political Economy at City University London. I also direct City Political Economy Research Centre. This is our think tank or a research platform where we bring together economic and political concerns, research into very recent or current developments, and we open it up to public and policy scrutiny. I work on finance. This is my specific area of research, and I have published various works, including books on the topic of financial crises, financial fragility, and regulation.
Now, most people are aware that there was a big crisis and bailout in 2008. I wonder whether you think we've learned the lessons and that we're now away from the brink.
Good question. It's also vague enough to accommodate a variety of concepts what a lesson would mean. Some people did. There are some lessons that there are some implications for post-crisis policy that would be quite unimaginable in early 2007. For instance, there is a much greater cooperation, there is much more data, there is much more work, there is much more, in a way, openness at the regulatory level. So the international regulatory bodies that were, important but technocratic institutions, some of them were blinded by some ideology, but a lot of them were in line with the market. They were broadly in parallel to the market developments. They were issuing programs and policies that would emphasize how important it is to deepen your financial system or liberalize your banks or open up your economy for further financial competition and innovation. This is what they were usually publishing. So now when you look at the IMF, when you look at the OECD, when you look at Bank for International Settlements, even the Financial Stability Board, which was at that time Financial Stability Forum, and to be honest, quite useless at its task in 2006, they all have become very much more empowered. They have more people, they have more data. They broadly now have much more understanding of what's going on in the markets and what went wrong back then. Some of the central banks are closer in touch with the banking system developments and with the financial markets, and I can say they're more on the ball. In fact, central banks have pretty much saved the world economy back in 2008. It was due to them, not to anybody else, that we have averted the full scenario of the 1930s. But, so this is the, if you want, the more positive view on the big transformation or a transformation since 2007. The lessons within the industry, I'm cautious to say that some have learned them, and that includes some big banks that decided to do something about their affairs, to clean up their books, to try to manage their risk better, to try to account for the risks they take better, to try to not to replicate the behavior of 2007. And then some didn't do it all. Some either had the privilege, in Deutsche Bank, for example. They escaped relatively unscathed in 2007, and that gave them some leeway to sort of not do a big reform, internal reform in the bank in the following years. And they're paying a high price now. Same for some of the European banks, same for UBS. And of course, it's all is very much overshadowed by parallel scandals that we're now so familiar with, the LIBOR, foreign exchange, and others, mis-selling of loans. Politicians, this is another segment. I think it's the weakest link in all this map. When compared to regulators or the banks themselves, I'm not sure politicians have learned anything. They have learned that it's not very nice to be in power when a big financial crisis happens, because it gets blamed on you. But then it's just the legacy and the complication between political, economic, and financial factors that have facilitated the disaster in 2007 is so complex that it's difficult to fit it into such a short-term political cycle. You see, all politicians, they operate on a 4-5 year cycle of needing to be re-elected, and it's nowhere close enough to what is needed to understand, regulate, reform, unpack the processes that go inside finance.
Because, I mean, you seem to be saying in some ways more positive than negative things.
I'm saying, well, look, I'm an academic, so it's my job to be, you know, fairly analytical. And I do see some change in the way finance is now understood. And this change, ironically, it hasn't been led by academics themselves. So, for example, the people who you and I, the public, would assume are to know about banks, the financial markets, the economy, the economists, they're still very much where they were in the 1970s, in the 1980s, and in 2005. They still construct their models, they assume rationality, and they maybe they now apply these models to banks, but they are very abstract, and they were not very helpful in 2007, and they haven't learned the lesson that economics actually needs to be a science of reality, or a science reflecting the reality. They're still publishing, you know, very abstract, very theoretical, quantitative papers. But at the same time, I do see more than the rhetorical change in the way regulators, researchers working for the regulators understand finance. And that's, I cannot not admit it. I also know that inside the banking system, there are, you know, big and small, there are more complex and less complex institutions. And there has been some understanding that things went wrong in 2007. But and again, I have to say it, finance is not only about banks. In the UK, the banking system controls, I think, if I'm not mistaken, just over £7 billion. And the non-banking share of the financial system, the hedge funds, asset management industry, pension funds, control over £4.2 billion. At the same time, the wealth management sector, according to the Bank of England data, globally controls £15 trillion of assets. This is wealth. This is wealth being managed directly and indirectly by very few people around the city. And I just checked, this industry employs only 31,000 as of 2014 in the UK. So it shows how fragmented and concentrated, but also very complex finances. And we would be making a mistake saying that it's only about banks or it's only about hedge funds. It's actually about many things together. And the shadow banking system has grown since 2007 from about $60 trillion US dollars globally, 225 as of last count by the Financial Stability Board.
We've recently had questions over Deutsche Bank. I mean, that's just literally in the last couple of months. And one does wonder if we're still in the situation where there are banks out there that are too big to fail, and that if things start to go wrong, there will be more demands for public money and more massive increases in national debt around Europe to keep bailing these banks out. What happened at Deutsche Bank?
Well, Deutsche Bank is the story that I tried to tell just a minute earlier. It's one of the big banks, global banks, that were not that wasn't as hurt as others in 2007, partly because they played the mortgage game better or the derivatives game better. But that also didn't push them to reform. In some ways, they were the last to close the fixed income department. So this is the department that usually deals with complex structures, potentially with toxic exposure. They were, my sources tell me that there are internal culture problems between top management and medium management, where the sense of illusion or delusion that led top management to current situation. So the sluggishness to reform, inability to act, inability to recognize the moment where they had to move out of certain things and reform their operations. So this is all compounded and is a legacy of that time. So Deutsche Bank's problems today is a legacy of that time. But you're absolutely right, Deutsche Bank is too big to fail. It will be, even if it comes to the very brink, which according to some market sources it already had done, it will of course be saved by the German government. Maybe the taxpayers will be pulled into the operation, partly because it's very easy now to issue government debt, especially if you're Germany, because everybody wants your government debt as a financial security in the markets. So it's not only necessary for a bank resolution, but also convenient to issue public debt when you're a big state like Germany. UK or US, there are three governments that are safe havens for the financial markets, and for each one of them it's very easy and cheap to raise public debt now in the markets. Everybody wants that particular collateral.
Another side of all this is the power relations, really, between the bankers, between the directors of the bank, the shareholders of the banks, and politicians that we elect, because we'd like to think that those politicians can put things in order to make sure that, you know, that there's not almost a great sucking sound as all people's savings disappear, you know, as has happened in many countries such as Argentina. So I'd like to ask you about that. Is it? I've heard some commentators talking about the way that the banks almost give ultimatums to politicians, almost like having a suicide bomber in the room that says, "You either you do this or we blow up." And also, they're in a very powerful situation, aren't they, because of the governments are now massively indebted. Whatever George Osborne has been trying to do, he's actually almost doubled the national debt. We're now at £1.5 trillion national debt in Britain. And it doesn't look as if that's ever going to be paid off because of the impossibility, it seems, of turning the economy around. So just could you just explain to us what is the real power relationship between the banks and the Chancellor and our elected politicians?
Good question. Half of Tory party's donors are hedge funds. Okay, so this is, again, an illustration that there is a powerful financial lobby, especially in the UK, around the City of London, and that includes financiers and lawyers who work for them and the big accounting firms. But not all of them are bankers. So, for example, there are big American firms, big American banks working in the city, and some of them would have very progressive views on how to reform the UK banking system or what is needed to be done, for example, on capital or leverage. And they are recognized problems at the moment. They're still, these are issues that are not resolved. There are also problems with accountability. But at the same time, yes, there is a view, and which I think I share, that overall, once you keep your banking system private and once you keep your banks as publicly owned companies, once they're too big to fail, they're systemically important institutions, they have enormous power to sabotage. And in this particular case, they are sabotaging what they are meant for in a democratic capitalist setting, if you want. It's not a very scientific phrase, but let's call it this for the sake of discussion. And that mission in an accountable capitalist system that works for the benefit of a society in a democracy is to provide the utility of banking service, payment system, clearing, and some investment for the public, not professional, but investment. But these operations are not very profitable for the big banks, especially when they're private. They're making money. They are over-leveraged and they are liaising with different clients. So structurally, they are the ones who are first in charge of our money. At the same time, they are the only institutions that create money in our economy. And they also are distributing the money to the economy by creating new credit. So overall, structurally, for any politicians, it's a lose-lose game. You cannot do anything. You have a nominally independent central bank you don't really control. You have a treasury, which is usually behind the problem. And yes, you have a fantastically powerful financial lobby with structurally important banks that are strategic entities in your economy. And yes, they do threaten that they will leave. Usually they don't, because the mobility of capital is being misused as a term. But at the same time, I have to say that the politicians, especially in the UK, did have a moment where they could do something about the banks. And they largely missed it. For example, they had several banks nationalized or semi-nationalized, and they didn't do anything to reform the overall structure, function, or indeed the morale of the banking system.
So in a way, it's the politician's own fault. Anyway, we're coming along to referendum about the European Union. A lot of people looking at the Eurozone, particularly the financial connections and the Troika, the European Central Bank, and saying, well, actually, this is not working for Europe, particularly Italy, Greece, and Spain, etc. And I just wonder what you make of obviously things are just going to carry on as they are if there is a vote to stay in the European Union. But I mean, if Britain votes for Brexit, what's the implications financially for the City of London and for the country as a whole?
I would quote a lot of people, but in this particular case, I would quote Mike Carney, the governor of the Bank of England: prepare for massive liquidity needs for bank bailouts. They will be exposed, they will have to cut risks, and their balance sheet will be devalued, because Britain as a whole and British entities will be worth less once Britain is out. So this will be a massive financial crisis.
We're talking about literally the day after a Brexit vote?
Well, I'm not really a Cassandra. Gideon Rachman published a very funny article yesterday in FT that I enjoyed reading, what happens the day on the 24th after Britain votes out. It can happen within a relatively short time. Usually banking, a creeping and a systemic bank crisis, it doesn't happen in a day. It takes time to accumulate and evolve. But in this particular case, I don't think we will have many months to wait.
Didn't we really sign up to an international banking system in Britain when in 1980, when we just got rid of exchange controls? Isn't that kind of the beginning of an almost inevitable welding together of Britain with other European economies and other world economies?
Well, yes, Britain is the global hub for the world financial system. The City of London works as a huge offshore operation for everybody. It's a center for foreign exchange, it's a center for insurance and reinsurance, it's a center for global wealth management industry. So it's very tied in not only to Europe, but to the whole world. And therefore, it's so integral to the whole European and global architecture that breaking this link would disrupt a lot of, if you want, going concerns. Okay, so Britain as an economy is a going concern within Europe. It does have its problems, and Eurozone has its own problems. But as a whole, it works as a going concern. And once you break this important part, Britain, that going concern needs to be reevaluated. And this re-evaluation will make, in my view, Britain much less valuable and also much more isolated, and it's unclear for what. So I'm ardently pro-European and I'm ardently pro-EU vote, pro-stay-in vote. What is it formally called? Remain.
That's right, yeah. A lot of people point to Europe, and maybe not the EU, but things like the Bank for International Settlements, as being part of the problem. This is the central banker's central bank, that they really have completely failed on proper banking regulation, which has led to the problems we had in 2008. And also that the BIS is basically a kind of self-regulation system for banks. There's no real proper democratic accountability and oversight. And just to pile more problems on, I've just read a book recently by Adam Libor called The Tower of Basel, which mm-hmm. details the way that the Bank for International Settlements is actually was intimately involved in providing foreign exchange for the Nazis in the Second World War, and actually financed large parts of Hitler's rise to power. So is it really time for a proper look at banking regulation internationally and the BIS specifically?
Perhaps. Again, to my earlier point, it's the BIS that has been possibly, probably along with the IMF, the champion of some sort of self-reflection and reform. Before 2007, and I think that book you mentioned was published before that or around that time, it was one of the most secretive institutions. You would never be able to get an interview there as a researcher. It was very difficult, and there was practically no literature published in terms of good academic research. And suddenly, part of the crisis impact was that they had to open up. And as a result, we have more communication, we have more data, and also much more cutting-edge and critical research coming from the chief economists and economics department and the research department. And they're the ones arguing and demonstrating that, look, we have the big dichotomy between the so-called financial cycle. Okay, a financial cycle is basically an economic and credit-driven development or a set of developments that is longer, that is driven by the elasticity of the financial system, and nobody knows how elastic it has become. Nobody knows when this financial cycle ends. It just seems longer than we ever thought. It's longer than the traditional business cycle, and mostly it's longer than the traditional political cycle in democracies. And they are saying that there are tangible political risks to not resolving the financial mess that we're now in, to not having enough tools to deal with the next turmoil when it comes. And yes, they were, look, Basel has always been a compromise. Basel I, Basel II, and especially Basel III. There is a lot of critique of Basel III regulations. I don't want to defend them. They're pretty much toothless on capital. They have made great progress on liquidity provisions, and they made very little progress on accountability. And in fact, they can say it's not our job to do accountability. It's national jurisdictions. But Basel III has been broadly on the ball. It does tackle some of the big issues that led up to that contributed to the problems in the latest credit boom in between 2002-2007. Without the crisis, we would never have got Basel III. And as I'm saying, although there are problems still to be resolved in terms of greater focus on liquidity, at least in terms of some attempt to understand what systemic risk can be in the system, it's pretty much as good as we can get at the moment in terms of all considering all politics, lobbyism, compromises, lack of democratic accountability, lack of people's involvement. But I actually have much more time for the Bank for International Settlements than you seem to have.
Well, I'm sort of pointing the finger at them in a way as creating the whole situation through self-regulation that didn't really work, that created the whole 2008 situation in the first place. But look, you mentioned there, you said crisis, the next crisis when it comes. A lot of commentators are saying that there simply isn't the money in the system to bail out the banks a second time. So could we see a more 1929-like catastrophic crash in the future?
Difficult to say. It's very likely that a crisis will come, possibly in the next 3 to 5 years. Whether it will involve a big bank or another non-bank financial entity or a set of financial entities, like, for instance, a pension fund or a big broker and somebody else with that particular broker. We don't know. I actually think that there are a lot of unknown risks in the shadow banking system, and banking, resolving a bank crisis would not be the biggest headache of that particular crisis. And that's sort of the danger. The danger is that we don't know. We kind of know broadly what to do in a banking crisis. We can nationalize, we can restructure, we can sell off bad loans, we can, again, issue public debt if necessary, it's cheap enough, but we don't know what to do with a non-bank, shadow bank type of connection, and we don't know how risk spreads there, where it accumulates, how it spreads, who's exposed, how international it can be, and what are the actual costs. And that, I think, is the danger. And yes, for that, because it was never on the public provision map, the shadow banking system, it's never supposed to be resolved by a taxpayer injection or a central bank resolution. Yeah, the potential risks are quite high, and costs. And in principle, shadow banking is a kind of privately driven system of credit intermediation. We all are linked to it, but it's supposed to be separate from the regulated banking system. It's not, but it's this is what they consider. But there is a big question. So if one of our strategically important financial entities, insurance company or a pension fund or something connected to a big investment fund that has public exposure, what if they fail through a shadow banking system? What would a government do? And last time when the UK government faced such a dilemma with Northern Rock, I think they left it almost unresolved until the last minute. Maybe it's still unresolved now. It was the exposure of Northern Rock through Granite, through a Jersey-based offshore trust. So effectively, because they were very integrated together, the two entities cost the UK taxpayer twice, not only 50 billion that the UK government granted as a bailout, but also all the obligations that Granite still had outstanding at the time of a bailout, and they also equaled 50 billion. So this problem can now be multiplied several times over in the shadow banking system.
One of the problems is, potentially anyway, and I wonder what you make of this, is that people have raised is that bailout money that was given to banks has been used for further lobbying to consolidate their power.
Partly. You know what they did with so-called tax, not so-called, they were called tax arbitrage departments or desks in the banks before 2007. They now were renamed as capital structuring desks or capital market structure desks. They do exactly the same, but they were renamed. A lot of bankers are complaining that their job has become much more boring. You see, the volatility in the markets, because interest rates are low, it's not a very fertile environment for innovation. So those who want to really apply their brains, their mathematical brains, they're bored. But yes, nothing has changed in the ethos, morale, or behavior of banks. I don't expect it as a result of the crisis. Bankers are still bankers. This is what they were.
The tax justice campaigner, and I think he's an accountant too, Richard Murphy, has said that. That the electronic infrastructure of banking, things like the cash points and the various methods which are used to move money around the country, around the world, I suppose. Richard has said that it's important that this is in public hands, so that if banks fail, that it doesn't mean that the cash points fail all at the same time. I wonder if you think that's important.
Very much. This is what I call utility banking. This is the utility, the public provision of banking services to the public. This is exactly our daily operation, our daily life depends on those ATM machines, on clearing mechanisms working. If they fail, there is a tangible risk that a train would not go on time, that a plane would not land or would take off, that you would not be able to extract your cash from an ATM machine. And that is a political risk. So, yes, it's important to have public control. What form it can take, it's clearly debatable. But I do believe that a state does have to play a bigger role in the banking and financial system than it does now.
But you see, the banks aren't going to let go of that infrastructure without a fight, are they?
Possibly, but yes, maybe there will be a compromise. And it's important for politicians not to be ill-informed, okay? To have a conversation with the banking and financial sector, you need to be respected. So very blunt solutions would not work. But a public agency set up for a specific purpose, or even an idea of a public bank or publicly owned bank as a contender, well, if it's a competition, then why not? Anyway, they have survived on subsidies from the state, according to Andy Haldane, for a long while now. They are private institutions, but they had been having a very good ride with an implicit state subsidy. And he estimates that particular state subsidy was around £70 billion before the crisis.
You used an interesting word there, utility. Now, I think of utilities like electricity, water, that sort of thing. And I think most of us would like our utilities provided roughly at cost in order to let us get along, you know, so that we're not paying over the odds for these things. And it's been one of the problems of privatisation that people are paying actually a lot more, for example, for energy than if it was provided at cost. So is there, by using the word utility, aren't you in a way saying that perhaps it's better that the whole of banking is just run like that by the government, by having one state bank that just simply provides this as a facility without taking a profit?
It depends what that bank does. You see, if it becomes a state-owned bank that does a variety of services, including commercial banking and investment banking and trading, then I think it will not go ahead on the basis that it will be an unfair competition to privately owned similarly structured institutions. But if it's a public bank that provides very basic services and it's the deposits are guaranteed in line with the existing law, then at the moment I don't see why not, apart from political pressure. Maybe some objection will come to me once we finish this conversation or later on, but I don't see why such a body cannot, for example, issue mortgages or provide checking accounts or even some sort of savings account to the public.
I wonder if you could just point us to one of your books or something that you think would be a good way for people who are aware that there are problems with the financial sector, that there's a lot of it is smoke and mirrors, as a way of kind of cutting through some of the jargon to get to the meat of how our financial system really works.
I didn't plan it as self-promotion, but I think the closest that I come to that is in my 2010 book. It's called Financial Alchemy in Crisis, The Great Liquidity Illusion. It's a very short book, a paperback. It was written in a very friendly language to do what you just asked, to dispel the jargon and the myth and this layer of obstruction about finance. So I try to be as clear as possible. And the message of the book, it's really about liquidity, how we come to think about wealth and money and liquidity in a particular way, and why this way led us to 2007, 2009. This is why I call liquidity illusion. And in very shortly, it's about the big transition from the 1930s to today. You see, we are now used to think of liquidity as something that is very fundamental to how markets work. Liquidity is impossible without a market being there. If we want to get a liquidity, if we want to sell something, we need to rely on the market, be it a financial market, a real estate market, or any other type of market. We need to rely on the mechanism of exchange, pricing, discovery, and realization. But it wasn't like this all the time. Very long time ago now, back in the 1930s, again, when academics and intellectuals were very concerned with what was happening to American capitalism, primarily American, globally, of course, but the literature we have is mostly focused on the U.S. And they kept asking, why? What is it about liquidity as a very important political or economic category? Is it about the asset or is it about the market? And a lot of them concluded that it's really about the asset. It's about something intrinsic to whatever it is that you're dealing with, be it a paper, be it a commercial title or a house. But they recognize that there is such thing as a natural or real liquidity embedded in a particular type of asset. It can be high, it can be low, but it doesn't always depend on the market. It's not only given by the market. And what happened to us with the whole advance of markets, liberalization, and a particular market-led ideology from about 1970s onwards, is that this recognition that an asset can have something intrinsic to it, can have a value and liquidity fundamentally inside it, has been lost. So the paradigm of markets deliver liquidity has become so paramount that Basel II, which you already mentioned critically, indeed has completely abstracted away from the idea of liquidity. It assumed that liquidity would always be there. There was nothing in Basel II about liquidity provisions. It was focused on solvency of banks, but not on the liquidity of their portfolios. And this is exactly what brought the system down. Progressive illiquidity, as I call it. So this is one of the publications that can shed some light on the history and contemporary dynamics of that.
Because I think for some of us, we look around and we see, well, actually more and more people seem to be investing in property and even just leaving that property empty so that they can sell it at the drop of a hat. And that's one of the major problems we've got in Britain now, is that quite a lot of money seems to be going into things like building, well, whether it's homes or actually, sort of industrial land or property that isn't actually being used. It seems like something's gone completely wrong with the system.
They're being used as assets to store value, to gain value, partly because there are no alternatives. The wages haven't been growing up. The yields on financial instruments are so low. So savings and credit are going into assets. They call it asset capital market or asset inflation.
And I suppose that might be because at least you know that you've got something at the end of the day. It can't completely crash the value of a skyscraper or a piece of land.
Correct. And numerous bubbles around the world have proven exactly that although there can be a crash and although those real estate prices can go down, something tangible and real is left behind. Roads, skyscrapers, hotels, office blocks, houses, yes. Also, it has to be said that, of course, with the whole pension crisis and pension reform provision, this is the only way for a lot of families to have any tangible savings for themselves or for their children. They cannot rely on the pension portfolio that they signed up to because they may not be delivering.
Okay, Anastasia, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest on the show, that was one of the world's smartest economists, Anastasia Nesvatilova, and also to Rick Margetts, our studio engineer. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Anyone can contribute. Just contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off to Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So that was Dialects. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Bye for now.
Chris Morris. disgrace and it is a public scandal.
Chris Mark.
Morris.
Also got the feedback reports, which prove that soliciting public opinion is the stupidest idea since discovering that you're made out of 90% water and privatizing your soul. Other instant giveaways include today £10,000 or a free Ford Herpes if you can remember your name, phone us up, and find something remotely funny and some fun.
We're hearing quite a lot of people being forced to pump themselves up. Do you think this is a good idea?
No.
Why not?
Too much pressure.
Too much pressure can inflate the head?
Oh, yes. Most decidedly.
And an inflated head, of course, can lead to people having too high an opinion of themselves.
Yeah.
So, how high should one's opinion of oneself be allowed to rise? Above ground level.
Above ground level? About 18 inches, perhaps.
No more?
Perhaps less.
And that, I suppose, would be determined by the degree of inflation of the ego.
Oh, yeah.
To what pressure do you think the ego should be inflated, then?
About 2-3 pounds square inch.
I'd like to know how you feel about the recent incidences of potato assault.
What assault?
Potato assault.
What potato?
It's a couple of incidences where people have been knocked unconscious by large brick-sized potatoes.
Shocking. No, there's no doubt about that. They should chastise them more. Give them the bloody cane, that's all.
So you feel quite strongly that potatoes should not be used as a weapon of assault?
Anti.
You're anti-potato assault?
Anti against assault, I don't like it.
What damage could you do with a large potato?
Oh, you could break a fellow's head, so to speak, couldn't you?
What do you think should be the punishment for somebody using a potato in a ballistic and bellicose fashion?
For 3 months in jail.
How do you feel about dwindling gnat power?
Oh, not very good about that, actually.
Small insects have become quite weakened by the whole situation.
With the whole atmosphere, really, and it's just got out of hand, really.
There is a ray of hope in that it's been found that it's possible to artificially boost their power by the use of microelectronics and very small engines.
So stressed out that every time you blink, adrenaline shoots out of your eyes? Are rabid baboons alive in your brain? Do you have a body so tense that your legs twang top E? Well, today you can win the easy way to drive out the angst and leave it in someone else's car park. Simple but effective. Throughout the ages, man has been soothed by the tranquility of music, and that healing power could be yours. In a compilation of the world's greatest works on, now that's what I call a good organ recital.
Liver and kidney and bladder and colon, nostril and lung and brain and tonsil, spleen, stomach, adrenals and inner ear.
Now that's what I call an organ recital. With full colour picture guide, a quarterly updated list of current market prices, and a special recipe book, 101 Ways to Make a Doner Kebab.
Why doesn't?
Why
doesn't? Chris! Chris!
Just...
Go! Go, goose and goat.
Of course, to consider the amount of space that you personally devote to gas.
Not really.
We're not consciously very careful about leaving gaps or spaces for gas in our house, are we?
Well, not really. We've never thought about it, have we?
What one item or piece of furniture would you be prepared to sacrifice in the interests of devoting just a little bit more space to gas?
Cocktail cabinet.
Do you agree with that?
Right. No, I would say we have several chairs and things like that that we could get rid of.
Which you would jettison in order to devote a little bit more space to gas.
Yeah.
Real challenge this time, and with a combination of wood fungus, mandrill adrenaline and Feminax, they produced an even more striking selection for the Best of Innovations 1989. The Sonic Pest Repeller. Safe for pets, but a distressing ultrasonic sound wave eliminates rodents by disrupting their nervous system. Switch it on, bang goes the gerbil. Or the instant steam cleaner. Just the thing if you're constantly embarrassed by the filthy condition of your steam. And at last, the £50 machine that puts your favourite photos on video. So much more convenient to set up the camera, illuminate the snapshot, roll the tape, place it in the machine and spool onto the selected picture, rather than the physically crippling and emotionally exhausting routine of looking at an album. The Best of Innovations 1989, we're giving them away because, let's face it, who would buy them?
What are your feelings about modern-day hair direction?
Well, so long as it's fairly conventional styles, not multicoloured or peculiar cuts.
So you're quite in favour of the strong direction for hair?
Yes, why not?
In your opinion, what would that ideal direction be?
I think it depends on the person, the shape of the face and their personality.
Someone with a triangular face. What would be the ideal direction for their hair?
Well, not too much of a bouffant style, so it's fairly close into the face.
And the actual direction?
Well, I think east to west.
Rectifying rubber finger stalls. Falling down half a hole. Befuddling your mechanic by retuning your engine to concert pitch. Liver fountains. Steeple accelerators for about 2 minutes. I've not succeeded yet, but I'm sure it is possible to smoke a pipe underwater. You see, the heat in the bowl should persuade the nearby water to steam, producing in the process a comfortable pocket of rejoicing gases, within which a satisfying and mellow smoke should ensue, with the water acting as a filter, as in the manner of the traditional shisha of kebab. The bladder of it is, every time I'm on the point of proving my theorem, some officious tripe head has me removed from the deep end of the public swimming bath and dispatched with great indignity. Clapton's teeth! Whither science now, I ask. Rubber gnats. Blundering hopelessly into a deep continental drift. Pajama excuses that slot easily into concave mirrors, like in physics at school. Thoughtlessly for etting, oh, move your ong. Raising yourself on one elbow. Not exactly a complete education, is it?
Through 17 bowls of muesli, explore the intoxicating capacity of lighter fuel, or throw cats upside down from upstairs windows just to giggle at their frantic wriggling and record the noise when they land. Because you'll never be short of an idea or two with 101 things to say and do on a rainy afternoon, including ringing up your local radio station and pretending that you've won a stupid prize just to make them say something silly. It's silly.
Hello, BBC Wiltshire Sound.
Good morning. I won a competition a few days ago. I won a recipe.
Oh, right, yes.
And it was on a Friday night.
Yes.
And it was a baby recipe.
Baby recipe, right.
Do you know how long it would take to cook one?
In a saucepan, are you boiling?
Yes, baby in a saucepan, yeah.
Yeah, about 15 to 20 minutes, I should think.
Until what?
Until it's soft.
Right, okay, thank you.
All right.
101 things to do on a rainy afternoon also includes tips for strangers to London, including LRT's request stop facility, just pull the red lever when you want to stop, a manhole cover remover so you can see which gerbil is winning, and how to pull 999 legs off a millipede so it has to hop.
Today we're addressing the problem of the impending stair shortage. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think stairs, I go up and down stairs a lot.
So I imagine you're the kind of person who finds stairs quite useful.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Yeah.
What do you use them for, mainly?
Well, I mean, we've got
several, I imagine.
Several flights of stairs, and we're up and down all day long, and I mean, it keeps us fit. It's always kept me fit.
What do you think they're more useful for, actually, going up or going down?
Well, going up.
Obviously, if we limited their use to just going up, then the wear and tear would be decreased.
Yes.
So perhaps you'd be in favour, then, of removing all the stairs used for coming down and simply leaving the ones which are used for going up, then?
Yes, yes.
How do you feel about the increased incidence of potato assault?
Potato assault? Very painful.
Have you ever actually been knocked unconscious, as a matter of interest?
Yeah, with a cricket ball.
Any thoughts on what it would feel like to be assaulted by potato?
Very uncomfortable, yeah. Hmm.
Think it would actually knock you out?
If it was big enough and heavy enough, yeah.
Do you think action should be taken on the use of ballistic potatoes?
Well, I think that'd be a government matter, you know, yeah.
Would you take it that far?
Oh, yeah, yeah, with this government, yeah.
Do you think there should be restricted access to potatoes or a limit on the size?
Just on the size, I think, yeah.
How many pounds?
Oh, I don't really know. A quarter of a pound?
Upsetting the over-60s by chipping their grandchildren into short, rude words. Clockwork diseases. Pushing all the days to the end of the week and then jumping down the gap. Setting aside the next 52 years to work out a way of driving round roundabouts without using the steering wheel. Looking at life through 12 hazy drumlins. There I was, attending to my fortress, when I was grasped by an unusually vast sneeze. One humongous convulsion later, there it was, out. So large, in fact, that the wheels fitted perfectly. Obviously, after that, it was no problem to drive the sneeze very fast indeed, straight onto the motorway. You don't need brakes in a sneeze. To stop it, you just pinch your nose and shut your mouth. It wasn't that I didn't see the juggernaut, more that apparently I was only doing 6 miles an hour and my lights weren't on. And you know, I must have been hit with such force because not a single trace of that sneeze was ever found. Signing all your checks, Ilya Nastasi, until it gets dark. Gaining people's confidence, so they really open up. Then nicking bits out of them and hiding them in trees. Driving two whales mad. And then back along the M5, really relaxed. Leaving the Earth's atmosphere. Absolutely nothing in your will. Ocean-going yachts, ocean-going liners, and ocean-going...
Shoplifting. Have you ever seen it happen?
I have not seen it. I only heard about it on the news.
What sort of shop do you think would be the easiest sort of shop to lift?
Shops for things at low levels.
So the balance is quite close to the floor?
Probably, yes.
And I guess the lighter shops, such as paper shops, would be easier to lift?
Yes, it probably would be faster, yes.
What do you think, then, would be the kind of weight which would make it impossible to lift a shop without using industrial equipment?
Something around about 20 or 30 kilograms.
That would make the shop pretty difficult to lift.
Make it pretty difficult, yeah.
Okay, wake up, WC on the radio. Take a look at the news file and the topicality. Nigel Lawson this week going on about mortgage rates. I say, what about less mortgage rates? Good morning.
What do you think of the latest rubber prison proposals?
The rubber what?
Prison. Do you think it'd be a good idea to build the prisons these days out of rubber?
Yeah.
What effect do you think this would have on people who are trying to escape if the walls were built out of rubber?
Yeah, they wouldn't be able to do it because it would be too slippery.
And what else would happen if they hit it hard?
Well, it'd probably rebound back at them.
bounce off.
Bounce off, yeah.
It seems like you're pretty in favour of rubber prisons. What do you reckon about making all buildings out of rubber then?
Well, it lasts longer and they stand up to the weather, I can imagine.
And in terms of safety for people and indeed their pets?
Yeah, it could be a good idea.
And rubber cars?
And rubber cars, yeah.
Fun with fossils. Howl at the wrinkled, corpse at the crumblies with today's exclusive list of words and phrases which you could persuade your grandmother to say because she doesn't know what they mean, when in actual fact they're downright filthy. And just to prove they work, we street tested the following terms.
Parting the beef curtain.
Yeah, again?
Parting the beef curtains.
Add unusual sparkle to that over 60s outing, wouldn't it? And that unlikely cake stall rejoinder.
Purple vein junket pumper.
So, again?
Purple-veined junket pomper.
Profoundly rude, horribly unfair. That compendium of filthy words and phrases, with practice, we guarantee we'll even have them bawling out the classic...
Funny butter.
Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police.
Whoop, whoop,
that's the sound of the bees.
Whoop, whoop,
that's the sound of the police.
Whoop, whoop,
that's the sound of the bees.
Whoop, whoop,
that's the sound of the police.
Whoop, whoop,
that's the sound of the Like a sample, repeat it very quickly in a true boy example. Overseer.
the sound of the beast. That's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast.